I was told that, had I never tasted whiskey in the world, I would not have been able to appreciate the taste of it at the astral level, though I should undoubtedly have tasted in the astral liquid what I presume to be the taste of whiskey. Charles told me that one day, when my Indian friend was instructing him in these things, he asked him to have a drink. He ordered a glass of water, telling Charles that it would be useless for him to order whiskey, sherry or vodka as he had never tasted them in his present physical life, so not being able to imagine the taste of these drinks, all the pleasure would be lost. The same thing applies to smoking. My Indian friend never smoked, so even if offered a cigarette at the astral level, he always refused it, as not knowing the pleasure derived from a cigarette, he would not have enjoyed making a thought form of drawing in smoke and blowing it out again. That sounded quite logical, and I felt glad that I had the experience of drinking and smoking, for I enjoy both of these simple pleasures. We sipped our drinks and watched the people. We could even hear the buzz of conversation all around us, and this bore out the point, which had been placed, that every physical sound has its astral counterpart and, as it were, sounds a note which can be heard by those using the astral body. Looking at the various types of people who were constantly coming and going, I should not have realized that at that moment England was fighting with her back to the wall, for her very existence. They all seemed to be enjoying life, and there was plenty of laughter intermingled with the chatter which continued without a break. P69, Charles called out to a young man dressed in Air Force uniform who had just arrived. They greeted each other with much enthusiasm. Charles brought him over to our table and introduced him as Roy Chapman, a pilot who had been killed in the Battle of Britain the previous autumn. He was a good type, and when I asked him how he liked living under astral world conditions, his reply was enlightening. "It's all right," he said, "but boring after a time. At first, of course, it's rather nice being able to get everything you want without paying for it. But the novelty wears off, and frankly, I would far rather still be with the old squadron. I thought it a unique opportunity for finding out things, so I asked him what he did with his time. He replied that he did more or less what the spirit moved him to do, and went on to say that, at the moment, he was waiting for a girl he knew, to meet him for dinner. I asked if the girl was dead or alive. He said, "Oh, dead, of course, if you still want to use that old-fashioned expression. It's useless making dates with people still living in the world, as just when you are in the middle of something interesting, they have to go back to their bodies." In the few minutes that were left before his girlfriend arrived, I gathered from him that he had tried all the usual games and found them pretty boring. To play golf, for example, and he had been a low handicap man before he was killed, was pretty futile, when all you had to do was imagine that you had a birdie or an eagle for the thing to be an established fact. There was no such thing as competition, as you only had to make a thought form of beating your opponent for it to happen. The same applied to billiards. There was no fun in making a big break when you could always do it at will. The element of chance was lacking, which took away the charm from all games of skill. I saw that, and realized that my Indian friend was indeed right when he said that life on the astral plane could be boring for those whose interests were entirely dependent on physical plane conditions. I asked Roy whether he had been fond of music or art during his lifetime, to which he replied that he had not. He had done a sport of dancing, and liked music now and then, but he could not say that he had ever given it much serious thought. I suppose that when eventually he got tired of meeting friends and living on the fringe of the physical plane life, he would find something else to interest him, or life would in time become boring in the extreme. His girlfriend arrived about this time, and he certainly knew how to pick them. She was beautiful, really beautiful, and they made a perfect couple as they wandered down the stairs towards the grill room, where presumably they had arranged to have dinner. I told Charles that I would have loved to ask him what his impressions had been when he was first thrown into astral conditions. Charles replied that he did not think he would have wanted to talk about that very much. None of us does, you know. I wondered why, but I did not like to ask just then. We went then down into the grill room and choosing a spot near a corner where there was no table, Charles made a thought form of one of us. A waiter arrived almost as we sat down and asked us what we would eat. Charles told me to order anything I fancied. I must say I was not exactly hungry, but the unique experience made me order a sole à la bonne femme, chicken Maryland to follow, then a bechamel beurre and a cup of black coffee. Charles ordered two Bristol cream sherries and a bottle of Chambertin 1933, this being a year which he said he knew will be good. I asked if these drinks were actually on the wine list in wartime, to which Charles replied that he did not know, but that in any case it didn't matter, for on the astral plane you got whatever you ordered, whether it was procurable at the physical level or not. I enjoyed my dinner, the cooking being, of course, as perfect as I had imagined it would be. I just could not get over my sitting, seemingly, in the Trocadero, having a perfectly normal dinner with old Charles, surrounded by just the types of people I knew would be there on almost any night of the week. Just then I caught sight of an old pal whom I had not seen for years. The last time we met was on board ship in 1935 when I was returning to Ceylon from my home leave and he to Malaya. I strolled over to him, leaving Charles at our table. My friend, in a party of four, was obviously enjoying himself since he was holding forth the way that he always did. I tapped him on the shoulder and said, "What on earth are you doing here?" But he took no notice of me at all and continued with his story, and he certainly was in good form for I could hear every word he said and his companions were in fits of laughter. I found it quite impossible to make any impression on him, so in disgust I turned back to my table, where I found Charles highly amused at my discomfort. How the devil could I tell whether he was real or unreal? I asked. Charles replied that he was amused at my use of the words real and unreal, for they just do not exist here. He explained that at first it was difficult to tell, but there was a difference. The astral body which we saw was not clearly outlined in the case of a man using his physical body the faint why, whereas that of a permanent resident in the astral world, also of a man functioning at the astral level during sleep, had a much clearer outline. There was another difference to be noted, and that was the silken cord of etheric matter which was also attached to those who were temporary visitors, who never seemed to be quite as much alive as the permanent inhabitants. You soon got used to judging, apart from the silken cord which was not easy to see. He asked me to compare Roy Chapman with the other diners in the grill room. There certainly was a difference, for the outline of Roy's body was more clearly defined than that of the others. The reason for this may be that when the astral body is being used as a permanent vehicle, the ego inhabiting it has no dual existence, as it is when the man is still living at the physical level. Our dinner came to an end, and as I sipped my liqueur brandy, I saw that a cabaret turn was about to begin. I realized the importance of people living under the strain of total war being taken out of themselves, when possible. There certainly did not seem to be any sign of war in the scene round about us, but one could see the strain behind the apparent enjoyment of the moment, for those present all realized that the future was terribly insecure and that anything might happen to them or their loved ones at any moment. The cabaret included a sort of dance by some very lightly clothed damsels, and during the dance they made use of every bit of space that existed between the tables of the diners. That took in the place where our astral table was situated, and again I experienced the strange sensation caused by individuals in their physical bodies passing through one's astral body. After the cabaret, Charles suggested taking me to a little nightclub of which he had been a member before he was shot down. I do not even remember in what street the club was situated, but I know it was between Leicester Square and Soho. The same procedure was adopted there as at the Trocadero. A table was created by Chakes for our comfort, and drinks were ordered from a waiter, who presumably was also created by the imagination of my brother. It must have been about 10 o'clock by English time when the atmosphere changed without warning. The nightclub was crowded, There were members of the forces and a fair sprinkling of civilians also. Suddenly the sirens, denoting a raid of enemy aircraft, sounded. It was an interesting experience to see the ordered way in which everyone moved and the entire lack of panic which prevailed as all the occupants of the club hurried to the shelters situated in all sorts of strange places, apart from the tubes which played such an important part in the safety of the Londoner during air raids. We went out of the club and walked down Piccadilly. By that time it was dark, but to us the light was the same blue-grey light as when we started from Ceylon. Already we could hear the bombs dropping, also the ak-ak guns that seemed to rend the air each moment. Then there was a lull and one heard the roar of fighter aircraft of one of the home squadrons going into action. It was about this time that I found my Indian friend was with us again. He suggested that we went to see if we could help. I did not know then what he meant, but I followed all the same. We immediately soared above the buildings and found ourselves hovering above London, with enemy bombers and British fighters all round us. I noticed that Charles was no longer with us and mentioned this, wondering if he had missed us in any way. I was told that he always disappeared when dogfights were taking place, as the memory of his being shot down a short time ago was still too vivid in his mind. "We will probably see him later," my Indian friend told me, but as a matter of fact I did not see him afterwards, although it is only now that I realize this. We glided about amidst the inferno that was raging, the bombs and machine guns being audible the whole time. For the first time I saw what the life of a fighter pilot actually was, and realized that some of the irresponsible actions indulged in by them between their jobs in the air were only the natural results of the strain at which they were forced to live whilst on duty. I could now very well understand why they felt that the old saying of "eat, drink and be merry, for tomorrow we die" referred very definitely to them, and who can blame them if they sought relaxation in every form, during the brief periods they were at liberty to enjoy themselves? My Indian friend tailed on to a particular fighter, which seemed to be in the thick of the fight taking place at the moment, as if he knew what was going to happen, and within a few seconds a sudden burst of machine gun fire sent this machine hurtling to the ground. We followed at the same speed as the plane, which was twisting and turning on its way to earth, and I saw flames appearing from the engine, which gradually enveloped the whole aircraft. With a sickening crash the plane reached the ground and the pilot was thrown from that. Nothing could be done for the unfortunate pilot. "Now you will see how those who have knowledge can help," said my Indian friend, and as we came to rest on the ground, we saw that, although the body of the airman was terribly burnt and hardly recognizable as a human being, the real man in his astral body, presumably, was standing by the body on the ground, looking frightened and intensely miserable. When my guide went up and spoke to him, he did not seem to hear or take any notice. I saw what looked like a cloak of dense matter, attempting to wind itself round the astral form that was standing before us. It appeared rather like a thick elastic material and almost completely surrounded the clear-cut astral form. This winding process took only a few seconds to complete. It seemed as if what I can only describe as a wraith, ghost, came from the physical body lying on the ground and was magnetically attracted to the man standing nearby. I was told later that is exactly what it was, and the explanation given to me is that the etheric double, which is forced out of the physical body at the moment of death, winds itself round the astral body in its effort to retain some form of life, for the death of the physical body means also the death of the etheric double, which is part of the body. Link to book on the etheric double / Dansk. My Indian friend then made a determined effort to get rid of the fear that had taken hold of the man, for I could hear him being told that there was nothing to be frightened of and that all would be well. The boy, for he was very young, seemed to be fascinated by the actions that were taking place all around him at the physical level. He saw the ambulance men, after putting out the remnants of the fire, which had raged among what was left of his fighter plane, pick up the body that was once his and reverently carry it to the waiting ambulance. I saw the boy flinch from time to time, as bombs seemed to burst near us. He wanted to follow his body, but my friend dissuaded him, talking all the time in a soothing voice, trying to make him realize that his troubles were over. Some permanent inhabitants of the astral world who were present, and easily distinguishable from the ambulance people and those who were helping at the physical level, came up to us and asked if we needed help. My friend told them to go and see to the others, as he would remain and see to our case. I did not hear every word that my friend was saying, but after some time I saw that a glimmer of understanding seemed to appear on the boy's face, whereupon the clinging matter, which had partly enveloped him, started to disconnect and fall to the ground. It was explained that this was effected by the boy being told to make an effort of will to disconnect himself from it. After a little time it all dropped to the ground and seemed to evaporate into smoke and dust. Later I was told that it disintegrates very quickly, because the etheric matter of which it is formed, is relatively very fine, compared with the dense part of the physical body. The boy then seemed to come to life. He sat on the ground, put his head in his hands and sobbed hysterically. My friend let him do this for a time for, as he explained, the boy's emotional or astral body had undergone a very severe strain, and the normal reactions must take place. The boy seemed to think that he had in some way failed, and even then did not seem to realize that he was dead, and forever out of that hell which he had known. "Come with me and we'll talk about this," said my friend as he took him by the arm and, without the boy seeming to notice it, we swiftly moved from the scene. Within a few seconds we were far away and in the country. My friend took him to a lovely spot near a wood, where there was a little stream wending its way down to the great river beneath, on the bank of which we sat down in a silence that was heaven after the inferno we had recently left. My friend started to talk, thus gradually breaking down the remaining sensation of fear and horror whilst the boy listened to a very brief explanation of what had taken place. At first he would not believe that he was dead and kept on saying, "How can I be dead, when I feel so much alive?" We then asked him where he lived and he told us, "Come along then, we'll go and see if your father and mother are asleep yet." The boy could not understand what all this was about, but he pointed out the house where his family lived, which was beyond Finchley, and there we found the family had just retired to bed, but as yet were not asleep. The boy did not seem to realize that strangers were walking about his house and gazing at his parents, and my friend continued talking to him so as to distract his attention from what would otherwise have seemed very strange to him. After a time first his father and then his mother fell asleep and as they slipped out of their bodies, they seemed overjoyed at seeing their son. My friend started to tell them what had happened and tried to prepare them for the news that they would receive on the morrow. At first, naturally, they were horrified at what had happened, but when they realized that their son was in no way lost to them, and that they would be able to see and contact him whenever they were asleep and out of their bodies, much of the grief which had hit them like a hammer blow passed away. It is a great pity that people do not remember what they have seen and been told when out of their bodies, but usually they remember nothing. I can now understand though, why so many people have a feeling before bad news is received, of an accident, or a death in the family. It is because they have been told about it on the astral plane and the following morning some slight remembrance of this has been brought back into the waking consciousness of the individual. After spending some time with them, explaining as much as possible of what death really means, my friend suggested that the boy go with him, so that he might introduce him to a woman who was already working at the astral level and who would be only too willing to show him how to adapt himself to living under these changed conditions. We then left the boy's mother and father, who still remained seated in their astral house, talking over what they had been told. They were not a very evolved couple, so they did not wander far from their bodies, which were lying peacefully asleep on their beds, blissfully ignorant of what their owners would have to face when they woke in the morning. My Indian friend then stood quite still for a moment and uttered what sounded like a peculiar note. It was not a whistle but it was similar to that. Immediately afterwards, a woman of about 35 years of age came up to us, out of the mist, as it were, in answer to the summons. My friend explained that to get into touch with someone at the astral level, One had to think strongly of that person and, if the matter were very urgent, to help that thought, one also sounded the true note of that individual. I gathered that every person has what is known as a true note, which is different from the note of anyone else, and sounding that note helped in urgent cases to bring the person needed to a particular spot in the shortest time. The person called hears the note and is magnetically drawn to the caller. The woman who answered his call was one of the many astral helpers, as they are called, who have dedicated themselves to the helping of those who pass from the physical world, through the process of what we call death, and I can now fully realize how necessary and wonderful is such work. Without these volunteers, not only would it take those who die much longer time to get rid of that clinging etheric double, for before doing this their life at the astral level cannot properly commence, but also the advantage of having someone to instruct them in the different ruling conditions can be easily understood. This woman was soon put into possession of all the facts of our case and, with a sympathetic understanding that soon put the boy at his ease, took him away to begin his astral education. I was assured that this always happens. No one is ever left to find things out for himself, always someone is detailed to perform this necessary task. In this way a newcomer soon begins to find his feet and enters into the new life that must take the place of the old one, now behind him. My friend then asked me what time it was, and on looking at a nearby clock, I saw that the hands pointed to 2 o'clock. This meant that 4 hours had elapsed since the air raid sirens had sounded, therefore it must be 6:30 a.m. in Ceylon. He said that we had only a little over 1 hour left, as I should have to get back into my body again at 8 o'clock in Colombo. He suggested that he should introduce me to other ways of life that can be believed at the astral level by those who are not bound by the desire for things, which have only a physical background. He therefore told me to keep near him and started off again. We floated over the sea with no land in sight anywhere. He asked me if I had ever been interested in knowing what was under the water, and I admitted frankly that I had never thought much about it. My guide then said that at the astral level one could come into contact with entities which belong to a parallel evolution, that fish and birds, for example, did not progress through the human kingdom on their journey to perfection, but traveled along another and quite different line, the deva or angel evolution. Before reaching the standard represented by a deva, however, they had to evolve through many stages comprising elementals, nature spirits and the like, and that if I wanted to understand something of this evolution, I had better start at the bottom and get to know them in their right sequence. He proposed to take me underwater and warned me that whatever happened, I must not become frightened, otherwise it would mean that I would at once return to my physical body and remember nothing of what I had seen and done during the night. He reiterated the necessity of getting rid of fear in all things connected with life outside the physical conditions, and asked me if I felt I could face up to things. I have always been the type of individual who likes to try out everything once, so I expressed my willingness to go with him. I was told to realize that going below the water could not in any way affect me in my astral body, for that body did not need to breathe, so whether one were above or below the water mattered not at all. We came down on the water, and although the sea appeared to be quite rough on the surface, it made no difference to us. The feel of water was little different from that of land. There was no suggestion of variation in temperature, and as we gradually submerged, doing it very slowly, so as to ensure my not becoming nervous, I felt no disagreeable sensation at all. As my head went below the waves, I was glad to note that the light did not change. It was still the same blue-gray light to which I was becoming accustomed. All round me were moving creatures, which I recognized as fish, though not in the quantities I should have expected. As we went lower, the number of fish became less, and those I saw were considerably larger and moved much more slowly than those on the surface. There were also great hulks of what looked like floating rocks, but on coming closer I saw that they had phosphorescent eyes, betokening life of some sort. My guide explained that these entities were indeed alive, that they were at the stage of passing from the fish kingdom to that of the elemental, that such things never contacted the surface, nor did they ever see human beings, as they existed in depths far below where they could be caught in the nets of fishermen. After a very short time, as we understand time, we reached the bottom of the sea, where we trod solid earth again, not that it seemed like earth, for it was rocky and undulating. But what a sight met my eyes! The whole of the sea bottom was a garden. There were flowering shrubs, sea flowers of many kinds, and rocks that glistened with a thousand different colors. Here and there I saw caves, which were not dark, but certainly less light than outside, and into one of them I was taken. It was the home of one of the sea elementals that abound at the bottom of the ocean. At first I shrank from looking at this entity, which was the size of a half-grown elephant and whose eyes shone in the gloom of the cave with a phosphorescent light that seemed to be almost magnetic. I was told that these creatures did indeed lure their food to them in the shape of sea animals and fish, by the magnetism in their eyes. I felt the magnetic draw and for a moment became a little afraid, but my Indian friend, who was never far from me, assured me that it could not harm me and that I need have no fear. The creature we were looking at was obviously aware of our presence. I was told that what we saw was its astral body. We went out of the cave and, as I was once again drinking my fill of the beauties that surrounded me, I heard dull, throbbing noise, which seemed, in a way, to resemble music. We stood still as it came closer, and soon I saw a company of about 20 strange creatures, neither fish, animal nor human. They had the heads of human beings in that their features resembled humans, but their bodies were entirely wrapped in what looked like floating seaweed, though much more beautiful than anything I had ever seen before. As they floated along just above the bottom of the ocean, they sang a song, while some played a weird pipe instrument, which emitted a wailing sound reminiscent of the wind. The result was very beautiful, and I was told that they were some of the sea spirits, who inhabit all deep waters. I could have listened to their music for a very long time, for it had a sort of refrain which kept on coming and going, the notes being instinct as individual notes, but more or less blended together into a harmonious whole. It was indeed a sea symphony of which I wanted to hear more. I was told that I could easily do so another time if I wished, but that it was now time for us to be on our way. I kept close to my guide. We soon emerged onto the surface of the sea and, without any effort whatsoever, rose into the air and continued our journey. Once more we travelled at what must have been a terrific pace, judged by earthly standards, although there was actually no feeling of speed, for within a minute we seemed to slow down and I saw we were over Colombo Harbour. A moment later we were floating through the bedroom window in my bungalow, which I had left less than 10 hours ago. There, sure enough, was my body apparently still asleep on the bed, but even as we stood looking at it, I noticed that it moved and turned from one side onto its back. My guide pointed this out to me and explained that, subconsciously, it was beginning to realize that the time had nearly arrived for it to wake up again, that within a few minutes an SOS would be sent out and, even if I were 10,000 miles away, I should have to return immediately, as this summons meant that the physical body had had its proper quota of sleep and wished to take up its work in the world again. I asked how it was possible to ensure that the body would always remain asleep for a specified number of hours. He replied that it was difficult to ensure this, but that with much training and concentration, it was possible so to discipline the body that it acted according to one's will, but this I gathered took much time and training to do properly. I asked if the tablet I had taken before going to bed the previous night had had anything to do with it, and was told that in this case it had. The tablet was a special kind of sleeping draught made from a secret formula which not only ensured the person going to sleep almost immediately, but also made certain that the body remained asleep for a period of 10 hours, unless awakened by some extraordinary amount of noise or on being touched by an outside agency. It was impressed upon me that if I wished to experiment with such matters as bringing back into the physical consciousness what I had been doing whilst out of my body, It was essential that I trained my domestic staff never to wake me or make any noise near my bedroom during the period that I wished to remain asleep. My Indian friend then told me that it was time for me to return to my body and that he would endeavor to impress upon the brain cells of that body the necessity for remembering what had transpired during the night, so that there should be no actual break of consciousness at the moment of awakening.